Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. In the late 50s, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and his wife came to America. It was a tense time. The Soviets had recently put a satellite in space, beating America to the punch. And then a young man named Fidel Castro rose to power in Cuba.
His two-day visit to New York over, Chairman Khrushchev flies 3,000 miles across the United States to Los Angeles.
Khrushchev wasn't exactly treading on friendly territory, but he did have just a couple of things he really wanted to see during his stay in the States. One was John Wayne. The other was a sprawling park with rides and food stands and storybook characters. A park unlike anything that had ever existed. Disneyland.
When you wish upon a star.
The people and eyes around the world are focused on these 160 acres here in Anaheim, California. This afternoon, Disneyland, the world's most fabulous kingdom, will be unveiled before an invitational world premiere.
Disneyland had opened in the summer of 1955, exactly 60 years ago this summer, and it captured the world's imagination. But now Walt Disney's rather amazing accomplishment has to reinvent itself to compete with virtual reality and kids who've seen it all long before they set foot in the Haunted Mansion or embark on Peter Pan's flight. Austin Carr has written extensively about Disney for Fast Company, where he's a senior writer. Austin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, the opening of Disneyland made a big splash at the time. Give me a sense of how different Disneyland and then Disney World were compared to the things that preceded them.
Right. But before Disneyland came about, obviously there were such things as theme parks and amusement parks and so forth. And when Walt first got the idea to actually start an amusement park, actually what he had his Disney folks do was go around to different places like Old Sturbridge Village in Massachusetts or Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia. I think it was the Ferry Museum, I want to say, or the Steamboat Museum in St. Louis, to just get ideas and concepts and inspired for what they could do that was different. But I think what Walt learned during that process was there was, you know, nothing like it out there that existed. And so when he set about creating Disneyland, which was originally dubbed something along the lines of Mickey Mouse Village, you know, he had his team dream up all these crazy ideas of how to bring essentially a 1890s style town to life, which would become Main Street USA, and it would have gas-lighted streets and horse-drawn carriages and a steamboat modeled after, you know, something from Mark Twain in Frontierland. And it was just this really beautiful experience that was not, you know, just about a roller coaster or a merry-go-round. It was essentially a Disney animation brought to life, filled with all the imagination and care that goes into a Disney cartoon.
What are some of the ways in which Disneyland and Disney World have tried to stay fresh over decades and decades and generations of people going to them and then, you know, taking their kids? But there must be some urgency to, you know, kind of update things.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that what separates Disney from a lot of the other competitors in the space is that it has both continued to innovate over these many decades and never grown stagnant, but it's also kept that sort of key nostalgia that brings parents back with their kids, back with their grandkids, and so forth, so they can connect over an experience, a shared experience that they had when they were growing up. But this wasn't the case where Disney built an experience in 1955 and then never updated it. They built Matterhorn bobsled in, I think it was 1959, which was, you know, sort of this swooping ride around 147-foot tall mountain modeled after Swiss Peak. They innovated when it came to line queues. So, you know, there was things like what's called the switch pack, which is when the line folds in on itself so that lines are quicker and you can fit more people inside the same space.
Are you saying they were actually studying like cutting edge line technology?
Indeed. Actually, when they were going this last go around, they brought in designers from Silicon Valley to sort of study line queuing. And when they were trying to think of new, you know, innovations they could do in the area, they were looking to the history books. And really, the only people in the history books were Disney. so they couldn't exactly study something from somewhere else and bring it to the park because Disney was at the forefront of all this line queuing. And they even innovated again in the late 90s with something called the Fast Pass, which was a separated expedited line queue to allow one longer line and one faster one that was sort of split up among the guests.
Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Haunted Mansion. I am your
Here When the doors in front of you open, you will be directed to a flight station with that number on it. When you get there, please stand on the circles.
I know you've talked to a lot of people inside Disney, you know, a lot of people on background who don't, you know, want their names to be known. But give me a sense of how much concern there is inside Disney that we're now looking at a new generation of kids, kids who are immersed in their phones, who play video games, who have these kind of incredible experiences. And, like, maybe they don't need or want a traditional theme park experience.
Totally. And it's really not just the kids that are having these sort of hesitations inside the park. I mean, if you look at the parents dealing with all the hassle of carrying around maps and tickets and baby carriages and hotel keys and handing out credit cards when they go to buy something at a restaurant or a gift shop, you know, leading up to about the mid-2000s inside Disney, there was a lot of, I guess, worry about whether there was too much hassle and stress at the park. And this led into something called an intent to return metric, which is basically when someone goes to the park, how likely are they to come back and how often? And around the mid-2000s, they actually noticed that metric lagging. And part of it was the stress the parents were feeling. But the other half of it, you're right, was these children, these kids who were immersed in Facebook, immersed in mobile phones more often, and just had different avenues of entertainment than versus what their parents had when they were growing up, whether in the 60s or 70s or even the 90s.
Right. It's just a lot more competition for their eyeballs.
Exactly. And a lot more competition even in the vicinity of, let's say, Disney World, where you had not only Orlando Studios, but you had SeaWorld and different things like Harry Potter World that kids were gravitating toward. So it wasn't just digital competition, but competition in the theme park space as well. You're right. So, for example, one of the things they realized was people had too many things in their pockets. They had to carry around maps and bottles of SPF and credit cards and money and fast passes. And so they thought, could we eliminate that? They noticed people had hotel keys. They said, could we just make that into one entitlement? And so what they came up with was something called the Magic Band, which is sort of an electronic wristband that acts as sort of a virtual key to the Magic Kingdom. It allows you to enter the park and access theme rides. It allows you to pay for things at restaurants and retail shops. It allows you to unlock your hotel room door and basically just navigate the park with a lot less hassle of pulling out your wallet or your cell phone or any number of things that you'd have even just a few years ago. And that was one of the keys to making the experience a lot more streamlined.
Right now, I actually have used these Magic Bands. You're right. It does make things more streamlined. Does anybody either, like, internally inside Disney or guests to the park say, well, now it is lovely that we don't have to get out our wallets, we don't have to get our hotel keys and everything, but is it weird that you know every cookie I buy and, like, every moment when I go into my hotel room and then I leave and then I, you know, go to, like, lunch? Or, I mean, you know everything about me and you track where I am at all times.
You know, with every technology company, whether that's Apple, Google, or Microsoft, whenever you share data with technology, there's going to be issues of privacy. The difference with Disney is that this environment is completely enclosed. It's entirely opt-in. And you're not sharing information in terms of GPS. So while, yes, the band is tracking you as you go from ride to ride, Disney is not using that information to, say, offer you targeted advertising in the same way that Google does when you go from one website to another. The added convenience that you get in this very family environment as well might mitigate a lot of the concerns that people initially had. Because frankly, you know, just because Kara, Walt Disney might know that you go on Space Mountain instead of Frontierland, the rides there, that doesn't offer them to market much to you beyond, you know, in terms of what a credit card company might do or what a Google might do online.
Right.
So I just think the environment that you're entering it is a lot safer and more family friendly. And in fact, Disney could do a lot more to personalize the experience, but they haven't yet because I think they're wary of a lot of the customer concern about privacy.
I bet, though, they've got some data mining going on where they're trying to figure out, well, you know, this is when people go for snacks and this is when we could make more vendors available to sell ice cream and this is when people who are over 20 tend to line up for this line versus this other. I mean, don't you think they've got to have people combing through this data?
Totally, totally. And I think they should, because this is a way to improve the overall guest experience. So let's say, you know, because they can aggregate how many people are in, let's say, Tomorrowland when they are navigating the park. Let's say there's too many people in that park and Disney can sort of understand that now. Maybe they can set up a character parade down the street to sort of ease tension and stress within that park and sort of minimize crowd flow by pushing guests to another part of the park where there are more cast members to facilitate that. So these are types of things that I totally agree that Disney is sort of going to do, but I don't think we should be necessarily scared of it. Like there's something that they're, you know, this is a place that has Goofy and Mickey Mouse. And so if anything they're going to do, they're going to have Minnie go and say hello and wish you a happy birthday. And I think that's the type of sort of family-friendly experience that they want to offer rather than, say, use what you buy in the park or what restaurants or rides you go to offer you some sort of targeted online advertising when you use your phone later on.
Do you think that Disney is still luring the most creative, innovative minds out there? You know, I think many people think of the idea of being a Disney Imagineer is sort of this sort of pinnacle of tremendous latitude in terms of thinking broad thoughts. But now there's a lot of competition with Silicon Valley. Is Disney in Burbank, California, not up in Silicon Valley? Are they still luring those most creative minds?
Yeah, I mean, that it's an interesting question just because in the same way that, you know, people in Burbank might be struggling to compete with Silicon Valley, I would guess that people on Wall Street are struggling to attract those smart and creative minds as well. But this is a company that has decades and decades of tradition and legacy that has basically from the earliest days of a child's life has sort of imbued this idea of Disney as a imaginative place, this place where magic can happen and a place where creativity just sort of flows through the ceilings. I can understand, as one person said, talking about the parks in Orlando, he said, let's be honest, you know, Orlando is not a hotbed of tech talent. So attracting talent to come to Orlando to actually build this sort of technology experience, you know, I can understand why there might be some challenges for Disney. At the same time, you know, the stuff that they're doing at this company is not like working at Twitter. You know, if you go to Facebook, you're building a feature and you're working on lines of code. I mean, the difference is at Disney, you can build an experience, say, with their parks and actually go to the parks and see. I talked to a lot of the people who are involved with this project, some of whom came out of Silicon Valley, and just they were describing going to the parks and seeing what they built and seeing these kids, not only their own, interact with what they built. It was just this very magical experience for them. So I can see that as a major selling point. And you also have to understand that, you know, it's not that just Disney makes parks. This is a company that owns Pixar and Lucasfilm and Marvel, and they're doing incredibly innovative things in the movie industry as well as with ESPN and television. So it's a huge company with a lot of different technological pursuits that could attract a lot of talent. At the same time, some of the sort of more startup feel that you might get in Silicon Valley, that's not going to exist in Burbank as much as it will, say, in Cupertino.
So this is a big question for you, but Disneyland opened 60 years ago this summer. If we go visit the parks in another 60 years, I wonder how different you think they're going to be. I mean, are they going to be just something unrecognizable? Or at the core, are we still talking Sleeping Beauty's castle, you know, the Peter Pan ride, the Mad Teacups, the whole bit?
Oh, man, that's such a difficult question, Kara. I mean, you know, I want to say, I mean, if you even rewind back to 1955, they had built such an innovative experience. I mean, this is something that the New York Times just went nuts about when the first day happened, when they had thought 15,000 people would arrive and instead 28,000 people arrived to sort of engage in this Disney fairy tale brought to life. And if you ask the New York Times reporter then, what would Disneyland look like in 60 years? That reporter could have never imagined that the park would grow huge in Anaheim or that it would expand to Orlando and Walt Disney would imagine something called Epcot and start building the city of tomorrow before he died and all the sort of innovations that went into that park. And now they're moving on to Tokyo and Shanghai and they have cruise ships.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to imagine not only what Disney will look like, but the technology that we're using within these parks will look like within, you know, the next 10 years, let alone 60. But I would say that my hope is that they do keep that sort of core nostalgia. The fact that if you go to these parks now, you still see little kids dressed up as Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty or Snow White, because those are the animations, those are the films that they love and they hold close to their heart. And the shelf life of those things is just really impressively long. And I think there's something refreshing in today's day and age about that. I was at Hollywood Studios and I saw a ride for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was a very popular movie in its day, but it does not have the shelf life of an Aladdin or a Beauty and the Beast. And I think if Disney can hold on to that sort of core nostalgia that makes kids' faces light up and adults' faces as well, then they'll be fine in the decades to come.
Austin Carr is a senior writer at Fast Company. He's written a lot about the Walt Disney Company. We will link to his articles on our website. Austin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot.
And one end note to the Disneyland story. I mentioned before that when Disneyland was still in its infancy, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev said he desperately wanted to visit the park. The U.S. government, though, vetoed the idea. Khrushchev was not pleased.